Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina Senator Richard Burr steps down as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee following the FBI taking his cell phone as part of their investigation into allegations of insider trading. We're 1 week into reopening the state's economy. We get an update on how it's going. Mecklenburg County is told they've been using the University of Pennsylvania model on measuring the spread of COVID-19 incorrectly. So they stop, and CMS decides how to hold high school graduations. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to flesh out those stories and more. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner joins us. He's WBTV's investigative executive producer. Welcome back.
Hello.
Glenn Berkins is here, founder, publisher, editor of QCityMetro.com. Morning.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta is the senior editor for the Charlotte Agenda. Thank you for joining us.
Morning.
And we're going to start this morning, at least in this first segment, with WFAE's political reporter, Steve Harrison. Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Mike.
And we're starting with you for obvious reasons. First came the news that the FBI had seized the cell phone of Richard Burr, North Carolina senior senator, in connection with an investigation into allegations of insider stock trading. And then yesterday, Richard Burr stepped down as chairman of the powerful Senate Intelligence Committee. Let's start with the phone. The FBI got a search warrant to get his phone. They went to his house in Washington on Wednesday night to take it. Is that normal operating procedure, and what does that tell you?
So definitely not normal operating procedure for a sitting U.S. senator. Presumably, they are looking for some kind of email, text message sent around the time of his stock sale or the time he was getting the briefings on coronavirus. Of course, what would be incredibly incriminating for the senator would be a text message to someone like his brother-in-law saying, you know, goodness, just got out of this this intelligence briefing. This is going to be really bad. Let's talk about our portfolios. Of course, that would be devastating. I think it's interesting, though, you know, that Los Angeles Times reported this first. I think it's interesting, you know, that this leaked. Why did it leak? And does Senator Burr have any friends in the Trump administration? And I think that's a question. And the answer to that may be no. They let this out as a bit of payback.
It would be accurate to say that to get a search warrant on a sitting U.S. senator, it would have to come from the highest levels of the Justice Department. It's not just some apparatchik down at the bottom. Correct?
That's what everyone says.
So the LA Times is also reporting that recently FBI agents served a warrant on Apple to obtain information from the senator's iCloud account. I don't believe that Barr has ever denied these trades. He has denied any wrongdoing in the trades. He claims that he made those trades based on publicly available information. Insider trading would be the opposite of that. And he's even called for a Senate ethics review of his activities. So what information could they be looking at in his iCloud account? The things that you just talked about?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I don't have firsthand knowledge, but Senator Burr has a decent defense that, you know, if you go back to February, there were stories all over the news about the severity of the outbreak in Asia. And Burr has been, this has been kind of a pet issue of his. So it didn't come out of the blue. So he could make an argument that, look, I've been watching TV news. I was really concerned. I was acting on information that we all had. And of course, but when you start going through his phone and his iCloud, you know, you have the possibility that there's a paper trail of him talking about the inside information that he got as a member of Senate Intelligence. And that would be pretty devastating.
So I keep hearing these numbers that he sold between $628,000 and $1.72 million in stock. We've known about these numbers for a couple of weeks now. Why haven't we been able to nail this down? That's a pretty wide gap, it seems to be.
So on the disclosure form that senators fill out when they're making stock transactions, there's just it's just like a column, and you check the box between when you make a sale, and there are these big ranges. So it would be from like zero to $15,000, 15 to 50. And so, you know, if you take the high end, you get to 1.7, you take the low, you get to, I guess what you said, 600,000. So, I also keep reading that
wherever this number falls, it's almost his entire net worth, and he's not a big stock trader normally, so this kind of sticks out, I guess, as like a sore thumb. But he's not the only senator who has allegedly made these stock trades. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein and several Republican senators, including Georgia's Kelly Loeffler, are known to have done something similar. Feinstein's husband, I think, made the trades. They sold more than $1 million in stock in a biotech firm. Loeffler traded $18.7 million in three deals between February the 6th and March the 11th. Not only did she sell a significant amount of ExxonMobil, and we know what's happened to gasoline and oil stocks in light of this COVID-19 outbreak, she bought shares in Citrix, which makes telework software. I think it's WebEx that Citrix runs, which is their version of Zoom, which we're all on this morning. So her husband is the CEO of the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange. Are those senators being investigated?
So I saw this morning before the show that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported that she's been subpoenaed. She's had to turn over a lot of her documents. I think Dianne Feinstein has also been questioned. But, you know, it doesn't appear. I mean, and perhaps her phone has been taken too. We don't know. But it just appears at this point not with the same aggression and intensity that Justice is leaning on Senator Burr.
So yesterday, much to the surprise of many people on the Intelligence Committee, they were left having to answer questions to reporters about this, saying, I didn't know that. He stepped down as the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee because he didn't want to be a distraction during this investigation.
This is a distraction to the hard work of the committee and the members, and I think the security of the country is too important to have a distraction.
Is that also standard operating procedure when a sitting senator is investigated to step down from whatever chairmanships they may have?
I mean, I would assume so, but goodness, this is such an unprecedented situation. I don't know if any of us, I mean, can think of a similar situation where that's occurred. But it certainly makes sense that if you're overseeing the investigators to take a backseat.
North Carolina. Well,
it's worth noting, Mike, that so often these days we've seen people accused of wrongdoing who haven't actually stepped aside quickly, and it's kind of prolonged things and raised more questions. So I'd actually say this was refreshingly rare.
That's Nick Oxner from WETV, who also covers politics for them. North Carolina Junior Senator Tom Tillis had this to say about the senator stepping down.
I do believe, as I said before, he owes us all an explanation, and I was well aware of the fact that an investigation's moving forward. We just need to see where the investigation ends.
And many members of the Senate, including those on the Intelligence Committee, as I said, seemed to be caught off guard by Burr's decision yesterday. When President Trump, however, was asked about Burr stepping down as chair of the Intelligence Committee, he followed a pattern very similar to how he's handled other people moving on in his administration.
The investigation into Senator Burr with anyone at the Justice Department?
No, I never have. No, I didn't know. When did he announce he's stepping down?
A short time ago, temporarily, from his chairmanship.
I know nothing about it. Nothing about it. No, I never discussed it with anybody. That's too bad. That's too bad.
So the request for the search warrant that led to the seizure by the FBI of Burr's phone had to be approved, as we said, at the highest levels of William Barr's Justice Department. They've been accused, that Justice Department, of essentially being the president's own personal law firm. Is it conceivable that the president has had no conversations about this at all with his Justice Department?
I guess it's certainly possible, but probably unlikely. And, you know, I think it's interesting, going back to what I talked about earlier, that Senator Burr doesn't have a lot of friends in the Trump administration. I mean, there's a couple of things there. One is that he's kind of more of a Georgia first George Bush type of Republican, not particularly MAGA. But the biggest thing was that a year ago, he led the investigation into Russia meddling and crossed a real red line when he subpoenaed the president's son, Don Jr. That really upset the White House. That upset a lot of Republicans. So that was a really big deal to go into the president's family. I mean, that's something that I'm sure has not been forgotten.
He did run the Russia investigation. I believe that investigation continues. He said some things about Russia interfering, ongoing interference in the 2020 elections, which the president says is nonsense. This follows on the heels of Paul Manafort being released from jail for the COVID-19 outbreak, but not the president's lawyer, Michael Cohen. It follows Michael Flynn, a case being dropped by the Justice Department, despite the fact that he pled guilty to the charges he was accused of. And now this, is it fair to question whether or not this isn't another example of political favors for cronies and political retribution for enemies?
I mean, I think it's certainly fair to bring up and to question. I think at this point, it's difficult to say one way or the other. I mean, because I do think it's important to remember that what the senator has been not formally accused, but what he's accused of is, of course, incredibly serious. And right. I think if it were gone the other way and leniency were shown and justice was dragging their feet, there would be an outcry on that end too. But you know, I think it comes down to what he put in writing on his phone and, you know, how much is there. There's obviously ways in 2020, everyone can find out, what you wrote and but you can also go, you know, do ways to hide that, third party apps. And who knows how tech savvy Richard Burr is.
Glenn.
Yes. The other thing this is going to hinge on is what he heard in some of those briefings. We know that he attended at least, I think, two briefings leading up to the stock transactions. It's going to depend on what was on his phone, as Steve said, but was there anything said in these briefings that went beyond what was public knowledge? And so I think they're going to be looking for that as well.
David.
One other point to make here is the early coverage of this pointed to the fact that he was getting these briefings and learning about this while at the same time saying different things in public. You know, he spoke to groups about kind of downplaying concerns about the coronavirus. And then it turns out that he may have been acting differently. And that's why lots of red flags were raised about this.
And in fact, around the time of this stock trade, I remember talking about this on this program with you guys. He had a private meeting with high, well-heeled donors, shall we say. And he said, this is going to be really bad, so brace yourself. And then we find out about stock trades. But he's not the only senator. Would it be sending a message if they don't prosecute the other senator, or at least investigate the other senators as thoroughly as they're going to investigate Richard Burr? Anybody?
Yeah, I would say so, and we'll see what kind of intensity Feinstein and Loeffler, how much you know, because presumably you would want their phones as well. I mean,
one would hope that the Justice Department does its job here and investigates credible allegations and treats everybody the same.
Well, and arguably Kelly Loeffler and her husband, who is chairman of the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange, might actually be the biggest target in all of this, of anyone who's even accused of this kind of wrongdoing. So you would think that they'd be investigating with equal vigor all of that.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to get the lowdown on Mecklenburg incorrectly using a report designed by the University of Pennsylvania to determine where we are in this COVID-19 outbreak. That and an update on what's happened as we entered the first week of phase one of reopening the economy here and around the state. And CMS reaches a decision on how to hold high school graduations. That's important. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins, that's our local news roundup. That's why Katie Peralta is here from Charlotte Agenda, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, David Borax from WFAE News, and Glenn Birkins from the QCityMetro.com. And also for this first couple of segments, we've invited our political reporter at WFAE, Steve Harrison, to join us because of the breaking news yesterday about Richard Burr. And Steve, you also reported this week that Mecklenburg County is discontinuing its use of a University of Pennsylvania model called CHIME. You may be able to tell me what that means because I couldn't find what the acronym meant, but it's used to predict the number of COVID-19 cases, and this decision comes after the model's designers said the county had been using it incorrectly. So fill us in.
So Mecklenburg County's health department over the last probably 5 weeks or so has run this model from the University of Pennsylvania. And each time it shows this huge explosion of cases and hospitals being overwhelmed about 3 or 4 weeks later, not enough beds, not enough ventilators, not enough ICU beds. And so they keep running it. And one of the first times they ran it was that we were supposed to be peaking in mid-May and that the hospitals would be overrun, which is of course pretty much today. And you know, it's interesting to me because predicting the future is really hard, right? No one's going to get this exactly right. But what happened in terms of the reality where we have about 50 people in the hospital and then the projection where there'd be about 2,000 people in the hospital, that was a pretty big gap. So I talked to the person who created the model at the University of Pennsylvania, and he said, no, they're not supposed to be using it now. Once you hit a plateau of cases, which is where Mecklenburg has been for about the past month, the model's no good. There's a warning on the website that tells people that. I'm sorry.
That would be Michael Dragalis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
From the University of Pennsylvania, who says you use it only at the start of an infection.
We just made a simple decision to say we're going to fit on the front side of the curve. We're going to assume that people are using this as they're ramping up into the epidemic and towards the peak. So just by definition of how we developed that, it's never going to fit you on the other side of that curve.
Yesterday, Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris had this to say about how they've been using this model.
As we've spoken about these projections and these models from the beginning, none of them are actually accurate. They're only as good as the data that we have available to us. If you've been watching the weather lately, you saw that there was a potential tropical storm off the coast of Florida, and you saw the projections with all the strings going in lots of different directions. That's what projections do, and those models change as information gets fed into them.
So we've been moving this curve, or we've been moving the peak date from May, then it was June, now I think it's sometime in July. And that's because they're using the model, and the model's only supposed to be used at the start of an outbreak, not once it has begun. So the upshot here is that they've stopped using the model. Does that mean now we're not operating in the blind?
I don't think we're operating in the blind, because I think we've had now like 6 or 7 weeks of data from this, right? We know that if we have so many infections per week, so many likely percent of people will go in the hospital, there's a pretty good sense of how this is playing out. So I think we have a lot of information now, and I think the information that we have that's real is a lot better than using a model incorrectly. And I think it was interesting in that same news conference yesterday, the health department said, you know, no, it's okay to use it. And it was this strange moment where they were essentially saying, like, we know the model better than the person who built the model.
Oh, boy. Nick.
Several points to make on this. I thought Steve's reporting has been excellent. I think it's interesting, though, and I'm going to do something I don't know I've ever done on this show, Mike, and that is defend local government a bit. What I worry about is that the county is going to stop releasing data and projections publicly. And one thing that the county has been doing really well that the state has not been doing nearly as well is making a lot of data and information available about their models. In some respects, that's why we know that they were using the model differently than what the model's creator intended to. And they've been open and talking about the model. And to that point, Raynard Washington, I think he's the deputy health director. He's kind of the head epidemiologist at the health department and is kind of the guy in charge of the model for the county, has been very clear to say a couple things. First, that the model is just one of many and no model's correct. I mean, they've been clear from that from the start, just like what we heard Gibby Harris say in that soundbite you played. But two, they were using the model to project scenarios of what would happen as we started to reopen. So it wasn't just, here's what we think will happen with the same level of social distancing. They were trying to project out, and they were transparent about this, at various levels of relaxed social distancing. So what would happen if we, you know, have half the social distancing we have now, or two-thirds of the social distancing we have now? And so from that perspective, I think would be why Gibby Harris could argue, well, we don't know yet, and that's why we think we're going to get a peak, because more people are going to be out and about.
So, Steve, final question for you, and I'll let you go because I know you didn't plan to be here this morning. Was the county aware that they were using this model incorrectly, and who brought it to their attention? Was it us? Was it the University of Pennsylvania? How did they discover it?
So, no, I just emailed them, and we were, because we've been talking a lot about the model, and I asked them and then reached out to the University of Pennsylvania and then went back to the county. And as far as I know, I don't think the county has then reached out to the University of Pennsylvania and said, hey, are we doing this right? Or are we doing this wrong? I'm not sure about that. But, I just think it's understandable. Like, this is the first time of this for everyone, but I kind of go back to what I said, where the data scientist was pretty clear. It was pretty clear that once you plateau, they only built this model for the very beginning of an outbreak and stop using it. And that was, I don't know, he couldn't get much more clear than, and the county, you know, is saying like, nope, we know best. So.
What? The county saying they know better than others? my concern is that, so Gibby Harris didn't say they were going to stop using all models yesterday, right? She said, oh, well, Novant Atrium have some models, but we don't know any of the assumptions baked into those models. We don't know any of the data or projection from those models. And so the county is going to keep using models and keep making decisions based on those models, but now we're not going to get to really know what those are and look like unless they decide to make those public. And I hope they do, because right now the Chime model had been what they were using to publicly make projections. And that's been a huge benefit to the residents of Mecklenburg County.
She also seemed to refute the notion that that we had reached a plateau. She mentioned that a couple times. So it's kind of hard to know where we are given the conflicting accounts.
So Steve Harrison, I'm gonna let Steve Harrison go because we promised we let him go at 10 minutes after 9. So, Steve, thank you for being here this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Katie, you wanted to say something. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say we won't know until this thing is over, until there's a vaccine, until COVID-19 is completely gone, when we actually reached our peak. Gibby Harris, as you said, Glenn, said yesterday that there's no indication that we had already peaked. And this thing gets pushed out further and further. I think now July 24th is the projected peak. Quite frankly, these peaks are used to assess what sort of capacity, what sort of extra help they will need at the hospitals to make sure that they're not overwhelmed. But to the average person, these peaks mean very little, except for just arbitrary dates that keep getting changed and pushed out. People hear peak and they hear something really bad. Oh, the worst of it is yet to come. People also associate peaks with, restrictions being in place for a longer period of time. And that's not actually the case. So I think that we have to be really careful when we're talking about peaks because, we might have already hit it. We just don't know. People don't really understand the purpose of changing peaks and talking about peaks as it relates to their everyday. So I think that that's another interesting thing that, will be tough going forward and kind of unpacking that for, everyday people who don't necessarily need to know about, hospital capacity every day.
So at 5 o'clock this afternoon, we will be 1 week into the reopening of the economy, phase one of that. And we've been told because they opened retail that we should go, if we need to shop, we should go in, get what we need to get out, not linger, not window shop. Is that happening?
It seems to be happening already. I think it's sort of a mixed bag in terms of how well we're doing and how seriously people are taking it. Since Mecklenburg County is not mandating face coverings, there are many people who continue to not wear them. There are some businesses that do require them, though. I mean, Costco is one, for example. Small businesses around the county can do whatever they want in that regard. This week, County Manager Dina DiIorio said that she will not require the masks, but businesses can kind of do what they want in terms of no shoes, no shirt, no service, or no mask, no service either.
Well, you're getting ahead of me. I want to talk about that in a couple of seconds here, but the first full day of retail shopping, the resumption of retail shopping, was out last Saturday, I suppose. And a few hours into phase one last Saturday, Walt Gouveia and his brother were leading an outdoor fitness class in Cornelius.
Everyone's just ready to go back to real life. Let's go.
And at Park Road Shopping Center, shop owner Aaron Strauss wasn't sure what to expect when he reopened his doors.
You know, we're hoping that people are kind of like stir crazy in their houses and ready to get out and get back to the new normal with masks and smiling faces under the mask.
Mm-hmm. So did that continue through the week, David? Are people flooding shopping malls and retail centers? And if so, are they maintaining social distance?
So I actually have not been out much during the week here, but my assumption is that people have gotten a little bit of a green light here by this phase one reopening. And some people are taking it as time to go out and do what you've wanted to do for 9 weeks now. Other people are more wary about this, and there's a real divide among folks about whether we should go out. And the governor and other officials have reminded us that they have not lifted the stay home order, that the default setting here should still be stay home. But for some people, I think the gates have opened, and I think they see that as a license to go out and catch up on what they've missed.
Yeah, and face masks seems to be a bugaboo. As you mentioned, Katie, Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio has discussed a possible no mask, no service policy. She did that with a bunch of business leaders, but so far nothing has come of that. Some businesses who did insist that shoppers wear masks experienced some backlash. So on Wednesday, when Mayor Vial Isles was on this program, I asked about why, if business leaders don't want that responsibility, why doesn't the government just mandate it?
Well, you know, it would be easier, perhaps. But I think that there's accountability and a responsibility in this community that we've always supported efforts to make sure that things worked well. And I believe that businesses can do this. They can say no shoes, no shirt, mask required. Just like no bare feet. But I think we all have to understand, if we really believe the slogan, we're in this together, that businesses can do this without a mandate.
County Health Director Gibby Harris has said there will be an awareness campaign about the wearing of masks coming out soon. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis has encouraged businesses to set a policy of no mask, no service. But there is apparently this reluctance among officials, and I don't understand why, because we do have this no shirt, no shoes, no service policy in restaurants. What's the difference? Why the reluctance?
Well, it's a pretty easy, I think at least that the answer is pretty obvious. Business owners aren't elected. They don't have to face the voters. Elected officials do. So we're seeing this reluctance, not just at a local level, but all the way up to the White House. Government throughout this has been very reluctant to impose restrictions. Governors have had to, but when it comes to things like mandating masks in retail outlets or other businesses, I think elected officials would like to leave that to the businesses themselves and not appear to be kind of bigfooting, if you will.
NBC, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we're putting this on the businesses now. And if things go the way they always do, I don't think a lot of businesses are going to push back real hard on this because they don't want to lose business. They want those customers to keep coming in. But the responsibility here, that means, is really shifting to us. And remember, there's two schools of thoughts about this. There's I don't want to wear a stinking mask. And then there's the other school that says, you know, my mask protects you, your mask protects me. And they're two completely different worlds.
Yeah.
The other problem that we're seeing with the whole mask thing, we haven't seen it so much here, is that at some retail outlets that have required them, there has been violence. There have been people who have become violent. There have even been people shot and killed, store workers, store employees, trying to enforce those policies.
Which is why I asked if it's so important and this does work, and health experts are saying that it does work and it is important, why doesn't the government mandate it, take the onus off the businesses? If there's violence that ensues because of a government order, then you go to jail.
It's politically unpopular. It is politically unpopular, I think, to do that. And a lot of elected officials right now are concerned about doing things that are going to cause protests outside their offices.
Then they should quit. All right. NBC News got its hand on an unreleased White House coronavirus task force report that said officials need to keep an eye on the Charlotte region because it could be at risk of a spike of COVID-19 cases. Why was this report unreleased, Katie? And how did NBC get it?
Don't know how NBC got it, but it has been cited several times this week because Charlotte, of course, appeared on it. According to this report, the region has more than a 200% rise compared to the previous week in coronavirus cases, although Mecklenburg is considered to be in stable condition. I think that raises a bit of a red flag for officials here. Trends overall have been looking to be going in the right direction. Hospitalizations are down. The percentage of daily new cases has been relatively stable. Testing is increasing. But this is a little bit of a jarring thing to see. Now, Mecklenburg County is the largest in the state. And of course, we've had the most cases of any county in the state. But at the same time, it kind of gives you pause and makes you think about what else needs to be happening here.
But this report is not just about Charlotte and Mecklenburg, because when they say Charlotte, they are including Anson, Cabarrus, Gaston, Iredell, Lincoln, Mecklenburg, Rowan, Union counties in North Carolina, Chester, Lancaster, and York counties in South Carolina. So it's the whole region that they're saying needs to be careful and watched.
Right. Right.
State Health Director Mandy Cohen says that Mecklenburg alone is not on the watch list. It's the because we're considered to be a stable location. So it's actually the counties around us that put us on this list. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, Charlotte is in this unique position that, you know, our metro area straddles two states, which have different mandates and different requirements at this time. I mean, South Carolina is way farther along in their opening than we are. Different county governments are going to oversee restrictions kind of differently and enforce things differently.
So Nick, I got 10 seconds. Go ahead.
You've had more testing. That means more positives, and that's actually a good thing.
Okay. Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, Glenn Berkins is here from QCityMetro.com, and David Borax from WFAE News. Schools have decided about graduation. Pressure's on to open the open things quicker, and the Panthers are talking football. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with David Borax, Nick Oxner, Katie Peralta, and Glenn Berkins. Glenn, the county began ramping up testing this week. How many additional tests have they been able to administer? Who's getting them? Are you chosen by the county, or can you go to the county and say, I'd like a test?
Well, in the last 7 days, the local hospitals primarily have tested somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10,000 people, which is a huge increase. I think since the first infections were detected back in March, they have tested over 40,000 people total. And so out of that 40,000, I think 10,000 have been tested in the last 7 days. These are people primarily who are going in to be tested. They are being self-selected, and they're being tested not so much for the antibodies or whether they've been exposed, but they're looking for people with current symptoms primarily. And they're looking to ramp up testing even more from here. yesterday at yesterday's news conference, Gibby Harris said that one of the options that they're looking at is to actually go with what she called retail testing through some of the diagnostic clinics here in Charlotte to do additional tests for those who might not be able to be tested by the hospitals or some of the more traditional means.
Well, the governor announced earlier, I think it was this month, might have been last, that some chain grocers and drugstores would open testing sites. And he mentioned specifically Walgreens and Walmart and Harris Teeter in certain parts of the state. Has that begun here, Katie, anywhere?
In Mecklenburg County, you mean?
Anywhere in the state.
I believe in other parts of the state, Walgreens might have started, and I think that Harris Teeter was supposed to start soon. I'm not sure if that started yet, but okay. We have been checking in to see if Mecklenburg will be added to that list. Hopefully we will know soon.
And as Nick pointed out, with more testing comes more cases, because you find out that there are cases out there as the result of testing. And yesterday, I believe it was yesterday or Wednesday, I think it was yesterday, saw the largest single day increase in new cases since we first started receiving reports about this virus more than 2 months ago. David, meanwhile, state health officials say early results from antibody tests show a small percentage of North Carolinians have been exposed. I guess that's good news. And they are crediting strict social distancing for that. But Mandy Cohen, the state health director, added that, quote, really early results show not a lot of prevalence here, which is not surprising. Is that going to help the cause of those who say we should reopen quicker?
I don't think it will. I think those who are advocating for a quick reopening might see it that way. Once again, at yesterday's news conference, Gibby Harris was very explicit in saying that most people in Mecklenburg have not been exposed to this virus, which makes us susceptible. So as we leave summer and go into fall and winter, not just locally, but even at the national level, we're hearing warnings that we could see a fairly significant uptick if we don't social distance, if we don't use masks, if we don't take measures to mitigate the spread of this virus.
David, unmute yourself and speak. Unmute yourself.
Sorry. Yep. There sorry about that. A couple of points about this. First of all, these tests are still being developed, and this is, you know, early results from something that is still not final yet. And the idea here is to see who's been exposed, even if they have no symptoms. It's not clear yet how effective these are, but you know, as you say, Mandy Cohen, the state health director, says the early results appear to show that the social distancing is working. But, you know, we just don't know yet if this is going to be an answer to this.
Yeah, and it seems to be falling on some deaf ears, because there have been continued demonstrations to hasten the reopening, even as we moved into phase one. And one flashpoint has been churches. Governor Cooper pushed back on criticism about restrictions on churches remaining in place while they were being loosened for retail.
What we're hoping is that ministers and church leaders will put the health of their congregations at the head of their thinking here, in consideration of each other, realizing that it is still dangerous to hold indoor services when people, more than 10 people are there, and those people are closer together.
And a group of conservative Christian leaders sued the governor yesterday, asking the court to throw out his restrictions on indoor church services. Can a decision on that come down before we finally move into whichever phase two or phase three, which allows churches to open? Is this just an exercise in futility, or could this upend things quickly?
There's, you know, Governor Cooper has a really hard job right now. He's under pressure from all sides to do things. We're just a week away from possible partial reopening of all of these, including larger gatherings allowed at churches if they do social distancing. So this may be a moot point in a week, although I suspect that these churches want full reopening immediately. And yeah, so that will make it a pressing case.
And hairstylists and barbers and others were among the first frontline workers to be affected by the shutdown. And now Republican State Senate Leader Phil Berger pointed out that most southeastern states have allowed these businesses to reopen, and he's called on the governor to give county governments the ability to make those decisions. Has the governor responded to that request by Phil Berger? Don't know. Okay. Here's another question that you will not answer. You can answer it, but you won't. And that is, why is it that Phil Berger wants local municipalities to make the decision about who can open in this crisis, but only the state could decide about bathrooms during HB2? As I said, a question that you will not answer. Okay. CMS has decided about graduations. The COVID-19 pandemic has had educators scrambling to figure out how to hold high school graduations in Iredell County. Is it Cabarrus or Iredell that they're having the Cabarrus graduations? Okay, at the Speedway. CMS reached a decision this week, virtual pre-recorded ceremonies. How's this going to work?
Well, there are going to be three parts to it, actually. The first part, each school will have a pre-recorded ceremony complete with guest speaker, complete with valedictorian, salutatorian remarks, student government remarks, much like you might see at a in-person graduation ceremony. Then later, after that, parents and students will be able to go through a drive-through ceremony to get their diplomas. And then finally, at some later time, which hasn't been designated, schools will have some type of graduation ceremony or have the option to have some type of graduation recognition. The school officials were not very forthcoming in terms of what that celebration might look like, when it might be held, that kind of thing. But they did hold out that possibility.
And what has the reaction to this decision been?
There's been a lot of tears and anger about this. CMS students and their families have said, you know, give us the graduation ceremony that we want. It's a big time of our lives. The argument against that is that large gatherings like a graduation are still a long way off. At the school board meeting this week, there were a number of speakers who basically gave it to the school board for what they see as the wrong decision on this, you know, saying things, you know, that like I just said, it's a big moment for us and we need to do this. CMS pushes back a little bit and says, you know, if we did something like a drive-through or a walk-through, you know, some of these ceremonies could take forever. I mean, the biggest high school has got 800 students in it, as my colleague Ann Doss-Helms has reported, and a ceremony there could be 13 hours, and I don't think anybody wants that. I think there's a lot of frustration here about this major life event being put on hold for the moment.
But I think we have to recognize as well that this is not just CMS. This is happening at every level of education, colleges. Every college university that I'm aware of has pretty much gone to something similar. All of the HBCUs, there will be some type of virtual commencement or recognition of the class of 2020. So this is so the decision that CMS has made is not beyond the pale by any stretch of the imagination.
And it doesn't rule out a future graduation ceremony, maybe in the fall.
There's also been some frustration among local media and I guess some citizens about the fact, Nick, that Mecklenburg County has been holding virtual hearings, court hearings, but there was no process in place, as I understand it, to notify either the public or the media about these cases going forward. Is that the short of it?
That is the short of it. Let me get you the slightly longer of it. This really came to a head on Tuesday. Mecklenburg County has been holding virtual hearings over WebEx for some civil cases since late April, April 27th. And other jurisdictions around the state are doing that as well. Wake County, for instance, is. And in Wake County, when they have a hearing, they post the calendar of their virtual hearings with a contact. You know, contact this person if you want the information to be able to log into this WebEx hearing. Because in North Carolina, as ever else in the country, we have open courts that must be open to the public. In Mecklenburg County, however, they're not doing that. And the public's virtually had no way to access these hearings. So again, this came to a head on Tuesday when there was a court hearing surrounding an effort by a local hotel to try to shut down and move all of its residents out. Media specifically asked to be allowed to get into this hearing and access it. A court spokeswoman said no, even though the judge had said yes. And it turns out that hearing wasn't even on a public court calendar. The court system, it's worth noting, court spokesman said yesterday they would add contact information for the public to be able to email someone easily and ask for access to these hearings. Said they would do that by this morning. I just checked as we've been on this, Mike, and they have not done that.
How do you explain this? If the judge has said yes, these will be public and will provide access points, why hasn't it been done?
Well, in the specific case of Tuesday, they chalked it up to a miscommunication and maybe. But generally speaking, the fact that this hasn't been done and it took a reporter asking these questions, transparency is not a priority for our court system in Mecklenburg County. And that is a huge, huge problem.
Speaking just a quick of point, Mecklenburg County puts out a calendar for the court every day, and it is, even in normal times, it's indecipherable. And, you know, the idea of getting a calendar that would be so clear that you could tell there was a WebEx hearing, that would be great. Right.
So speaking of transparency or lack thereof, the city has been working to revamp the old Eastland Mall site to incorporate housing and soccer and other things. And some have complained that the process, here it comes, hasn't been very transparent. The city responded to that this week, I believe. What did they say? Katie, David, I think you both covered this.
They said that they are doing the best that they can given the circumstances. This is something that the city has been working on for a very long time. The city has owned this property since 2011, 2012, and they have been desperate to make it into something. So they're getting the ball rolling on this major redevelopment that includes residences, offices, and MLS headquarters. But these public hearings have been done virtually, and that's really difficult to do when you rely on or when you are trying to seek public input. Not everybody has good internet connection. Not everyone has a laptop that they could stream this on. It's very different than having these things in person where people can come up, show up in droves.
Isn't there a government channel?
Yes. Yeah, there's a government channel.
Can you not watch it on the government channel?
Yeah, but you can't chime in with your questions and concerns when you're watching it on the
government. Although they did allow people to submit the questions in writing. So this week's session was a Q&A that was done reading questions that were submitted in advance or submitted during the meeting.
And there's going to be a virtual public hearing on proposed rezoning this coming Monday as well. I guess you can go to some website and find out how to get into this meeting. Is that true?
City Council agenda page would be the way to go.
Okay. All sports around the country ended in March as this epidemic took over. So far, baseball has yet to open its season, and people are now wondering about football at all levels, college, high school, and NFL. Panthers owner David Tepper, however, is most concerned about his team and the NFL. And Monday on CNBC, he said he's looking to what other leagues might do as a guide for the NFL.
Well, I think if baseball comes and you see them playing soccer in Europe and we're scheduled for football, I think there should be enough tests available to make sure that we're safe on the field. As far as fans on the stadium, you know, if anybody's comfortable going into, you know, you won't be having full stadiums, but that doesn't mean you can't have some fans in the stadium either. If you're comfortable being in a closed airplane for a cross-country trip, 18 inches apart, maybe with two seats in between you and being 5 feet away from each other, you might be comfortable in an open-air stadium.
And this week saw the wheels begin to turn on the process of moving the Panthers to a new stadium. Katie, is there any other way to read Charlotte Pipe and Foundry's decision to move to Stanley County, or for that matter, Stanley County's decision to offer them tax incentives to move to Stanley County, if the Panthers didn't want that piece of property?
So the move to Stanley County for Charlotte Pipe has been years in the making. They had started acquiring property out there, I think, over a decade ago. It was a few years ago that they received tax incentives from the state to begin the process of relocating. So it was sort of always in the cards. Now, last November was the first time David Tepper publicly said that the Pipe and Foundry site might be a good spot for a new NFL stadium one day. And he has made no secret of the fact that Bank of America Stadium is aging. It is not suitable to host a Super Bowl or Final Fours or any of the big events that he wants to hold in Charlotte. So I think eventually one day we could see it as a big new NFL site.
Katie Peralta is senior editor of Charlotte Agenda. Glenn Burton is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Nick Oxner, investigative reporter for WBTV. And David Warrix, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.